Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the News Hour tonight, vast areas of Canada burn while Maui continues its recovery from wildfires as the official responsible for not activating alert sirens resigns. President Biden meets with the leaders of Japan and South Korea to shore up alliances amid increasing instability in the Pacific. And Israel's Minister for Strategic Affairs discusses the tumultuous politics at home and his country's potential diplomatic deal with Saudi Arabia.
Let's not underestimate the impact that an Israeli-Saudi peace agreement could have on the region and the world. It would effectively be at least the beginning of the end of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Good evening and welcome to the News Hour. The impact of wildfires is being felt on two fronts tonight. On Maui, residents there are trying to rebuild their lives days after fires scorched parts of the island as they mourn the many lives lost. But for one city in Canada's Northwest Territories, the fire danger is only just beginning.
Traffic lined the only highway out of Yellowknife today while other residents packed airports amid urgent orders to evacuate.
I've never seen anything like it, and I've never heard anyone speculate that in my lifetime something like this would happen.
It's a race against time. A wildfire rages just a few miles north of Yellowknife, the capital of Canada's Northwest Territories, and home to some 20,000 people. Forecasters say strong winds could push the flames into the city by the weekend. This year has been the worst wildfire season in Canada's history. More than 51,000 square miles have burned so far. That's far more than the country's average wildfire season, which typically scorches 9,000 square miles. The wildfire danger also extends to British Columbia, as a heat wave is bringing sweltering temperatures.
This weather event has the potential to be the most challenging 24 to 48 hours of the summer from a fire perspective. We are expecting significant growth and we are expecting our resources to be challenged.
Meantime, on Maui, local authorities are facing scrutiny after last week's wildfire wiped away the entire town of Lahaina, seemingly without warning.
Do you regret not sounding the sirens?
I do not. The sirens, as I mentioned earlier, is used primarily for tsunamis, and that's the reason why.
Maui's emergency services chief, who defended his decision to not sound outdoor alert sirens as the fire raged, resigned overnight, citing health reasons. That's as relief efforts continue. Those whose homes were spared are banding together to help in any way they can.
It's a touchy situation right now, because for us as a community, of course we're happy that we have our homes, but our heart aches because that's our other neighbors and our families.
The search for victims continues with more than 1,000 people still missing as of this morning. President Biden is scheduled to visit the island on Monday.
In the day's other headlines, a Category 4 hurricane brewing over the Pacific Ocean could weaken and become the first tropical storm to reach Southern California in 84 years. It's currently located off Mexico's western coast, packing sustained winds of 130 miles per hour. Forecasters expect it to weaken by the time it hits Southern California on Sunday. It could bring heavy rain and flash floods to the state and other parts of the Southwest. Parts of the Spanish island of Tenerife are engulfed in flames and thick smoke tonight. It's the worst wildfire the area has seen in decades, burning through the wooded hillsides that make it a major tourist destination in the Canary Islands. As firefighters raced to contain the blaze, nearly 8,000 people in the affected regions were left fearing for their homes.
Our lives are left there. Human lives are more important, obviously, but it could have been avoided. And we believe that not enough has been done to prevent it from getting here. That is the sorrow we have. It's not the material, no, it's our life. It's our roots, the work of our relatives, of our parents.
The Canary Islands, like much of mainland Spain, have been suffering through droughts for the past few years. The hot and arid conditions have caused the fire to spread rapidly. Russian air defenses said they shot down another Ukrainian drone over Moscow. Some of the fragments crashed into an exhibition center a few miles from the Kremlin. There were no casualties. Meantime, the U.S. gave its approval for the Netherlands and Denmark to deliver F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. It's unclear when they'll enter the conflict, but it could take as long as a year to train the pilots. And stocks were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 26 points to close at 34,500. The NASDAQ fell 26 points. The S&P 500 lost a fraction of a point. And former First Lady Rosalynn Carter celebrated her 96th birthday today at home in Plains, Georgia. The Carter Center said the festivities included cupcakes, peanut butter ice cream, and releasing butterflies in her garden. Mrs. Carter is the second oldest presidential spouse in U.S. history. She's been diagnosed with dementia, while former President Jimmy Carter continues to receive hospice care. They're the longest married first couple to date. Happy birthday to her. And still to come on the NewsHour, we look at the rising threats against judges, juries, and election workers. David Brooks and Ruth Marcus weigh in on the week's political headlines. And comedian Atsuko Okatsuka talks about her journey to the stage in her first special.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
President Biden met today with the leaders of Japan and South Korea at Camp David, the presidential retreat. Japan and South Korea have long had antagonistic relations, but today's meeting is a new starting point for the two countries. They released the Camp David principles, in which they promised to consult with one another if either felt their security was threatened. They also committed to improving military coordination by sharing real-time information about North Korean ballistic missile launches. Along with the U.S., they'll expand trilateral military exercises and establish a three-way hotline for crisis communication. President Biden said today's agreements would have long-lasting effects.
This is a historic meeting, but we're about to, we've laid in place a long-term structure for a relationship that will last and have a phenomenal impact, not just in Asia, but around the world. This is a big deal. This is a big deal.
A big deal, he says. Well, just how significant are the new agreements? Mike Mochizuki is a professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University. He focuses on Japan and security in Asia. Welcome back to the NewsHour. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me on the program.
So these agreements on joint military and technology initiatives come against the backdrop of Beijing's growing power. In your view, what impact will this have?
Well, first of all, I think what it does is it enhances deterrence and coordination among the United States, Japan, and South Korea to counter the aggressive behavior by China. But there could also be a negative consequence of the Camp David summit, and that is that it could intensify the confrontational divide between the United States, Japan, and South Korea on the one hand, and China, North Korea, and Russia on the other hand. And as a result of the Camp David meeting, the other trilateral could respond in ways that could actually undermine the security of Japan and South Korea.
Well, one imagines that the annual joint military exercises between Japan and South Korea would most anger the Chinese government. Of course, China just finished its own exercises with Russia. How might China respond to that?
Okay, well, what China will do is most likely engage in gray zone behavior, engage in more military exercises in Japan's neighborhood with Russia, and will be less of a constraining force on North Korea in terms of the development of its nuclear weapons program. And the real concern, I think, for Japan and South Korea is that this could lead to a real divide in Asia between those countries that seem to be much more dependent upon China and the countries in Asia that are aligned with the United States.
What might this mean for Taiwan? Because the three countries have an interest in the Taiwan Strait and the East China Sea.
Yes. Well, certainly the Camp David statement talked about the importance of peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. And this is something that the leaders of Japan and the United States and South Korea and the United States have already said in other joint statements. But I think the real concern is that there might not be any kind of restraining factor in terms of the intensification of tensions across the Taiwan Strait. And I sense that in both Japan and South Korea, there's a feeling that the United States may be overreacting to some of the provocations by China, and in so doing, might be exacerbating the tensions and ultimately increasing the danger of military conflict over the Taiwan Strait. So both Seoul and Tokyo would be very much interested in having the United States engage in a serious dialogue with China in order to stabilize relations with China and try to defuse tensions across the Taiwan Strait.
This summit has been a real shot in the arm for American diplomacy in Asia because the troubled relationship between South Korea and Japan has long been this sort of like weak link in Washington's efforts in the Indo-Pacific. Why was the moment right now to bring this together, and how was the Biden administration able to do it?
Well, I think the major credit has to go to President Yoon. Japan and South Korea had been locked in tensions regarding the wartime forced labor issue. Japan insisted that the forced labor issue had been resolved in the 1965 normalization process. In the end, President Yoon made the bold decision to basically make a dramatic concession to Japan and have the South Koreans pay for the compensation for victims of forced labor. Now, unfortunately, this has not been a popular decision in South Korea. 60% of the South Korean public opposed the decision by President Yoon. So I think what President Yoon has been trying to do is to move very rapidly to improve security relations with Japan as well as the United States to lock in these gains so that they will survive even after his presidential term ends in 2027. Mm-hmm. And President Biden has seized this opportunity, this historic opportunity, to move the ball forward by inviting both Prime Minister Kishida and President Yoon to Camp David.
Mike Mochizuki, thank you for your insights this evening. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
A top-level Israeli delegation is here in Washington this week to discuss the broad outlines of a once unthinkable agreement between Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to normalize diplomatic relations. Nick Schifrin explains.
Several agreements shepherded by the Trump administration between Israel and its former adversaries comes now the prospect of the biggest prize. But at what price? For Israel, the United States, and Saudi Arabia. At the same time, unprecedented civil upheaval grips Israel as Benjamin Netanyahu's government looks to restrain the country's Supreme Court in what his critics say could destroy the nature of Israeli democracy. With me now to discuss this and more is the Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer. Ambassador Dermer, thanks very much. Welcome to the NewsHour. As I said, among the topics that you are here in Washington to discuss is the possible normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which U.S. officials tell me they are prioritizing, hoping in the next year. And part of that would be allowing Saudi Arabia to have civil nuclear capacity, including enrichment. Does the Israeli government support that?
Like so many things, the devil's in the details, and we're going to have to look at what ultimately is agreed upon. And you're right, the Saudis have put that a civilian nuclear program, which you probably are aware of, they, as signatories of the NPT, they could go to China or they can go to France tomorrow and they could set up, ask them to set up a civil nuclear program and to allow for domestic enrichment. They could do that tomorrow if they wanted to. So the question that I ask myself is, if the U.S. is involved in this, what will that mean 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road, and what's the alternative? And there are other issues the Saudis have put forward
as well. But it sounds like you're not against it, certainly. And that is not necessarily the policy of the Israeli government over the last few decades. There's been a long tradition opposing nuclear expansion in the region. It used to be known as the Begin Doctrine. After Menachem Begin, of course, former prime minister, founder of the Likud party, who, of course, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is a member of, Begin bombed an Iraqi nuclear reactor to prove his doctrine. Does this Israeli government believe the Begin Doctrine no longer applies?
No, the Begin Doctrine definitely applies. You have countries in the region that can have civilian nuclear power. That's a different story than a nuclear weapons program.
You're also, of course, asking for something. The prime minister's former national security advisor, Meir Ben-Shabbat, said this: Saudi Arabia joining the nuclear club would produce a widening of nuclear proliferation in the region. Other countries would work to acquire uranium enrichment capabilities in their own territory. So what does Israel want in exchange for that?
We're not going to agree to any nuclear weapons program with any of our neighbors. And the question will be, when it comes to the details of an agreement, what are the safeguards? And what happens if they take another path, if they take a path with the Chinese or something else? We have to think through that whole thing. But let's not underestimate the impact that an Israeli-Saudi peace agreement could have on the region and the world. I think if you get a Saudi-Israeli peace, you're going to have several other Arab countries and Muslim countries are going to follow.
Sure, but
I think it's the ultimate game changer.
But we also have to deal with the Palestinians. Of course, Saudi Arabia will demand significant concessions from Israel when it comes to the Palestinians. Let me give you some options: ending illegal settlement activity, curbing especially large settlements, strengthening the Palestinian Authority, and expanding the territory under its jurisdiction. Are you willing to give any or all of that to the Saudis?
This may surprise you, but I'm actually not going to negotiate on PBS. What we'll do, I will say, the way we look at this issue, it's not just this is that this or that price for Israel. We would like to ultimately achieve a peace agreement with our Palestinian neighbors.
Saudis are making clear there's no peace with Saudi Arabia until there are these concessions for the Palestinians.
Well, I don't think they've been specific about what concessions.
They haven't, which is why I gave you some options.
I think what Saudi Arabia looks at this move with the United States is something that will anchor their alliance with America for a half century. And I think we both have an interest in seeing if we can get the Palestinians on a path which can ultimately lead to a political settlement of the conflict.
Let's talk about judicial reform. These are efforts the prime minister describes as reforms to Israel's, quote, all-powerful judiciary.
Right.
You represent the government coalition that's negotiating with the opposition in the president's house in Israel. In the United States, as you know well, if the House of Representatives, by a small majority, wants to abuse the rights of the minority, it would pass a law that goes through the House, through the Senate, signed by the President of the United States, go through the federal court system, the Supreme Court, as guaranteed by the Constitution. In Israel, if the Knesset, if the parliament, wants to impose its majority on the minority, there's only one check: the Israeli Supreme Court. Why are you trying to remove that check?
Well, we're not trying to remove the check. I think there's been a lot of misreporting on that. There are many checks that the Supreme Court has on the authority of the executive branch and even on the Knesset. When a law is passed, they can decide whether the law is there's a conflict of interest, whether there was due process, whether it's proportionate, all these other checks. But there was an extra check that you don't have in your system here, which is the judges could decide, we don't believe this is reasonable. In Israel, you cannot replace the will of the public elected through their elected representatives with 15 unelected judges to decide that this is reasonable or unreasonable.
Since you've been pushing this through, there have obviously been massive, unprecedented protests across the country. The shekel's lost value. Private capital inflows are down. Israel startups are registering abroad. Moody's, S&P have warned about investing in Israel. And, of course, the military in Israel have repeatedly warned there is a crisis of readiness because of the fissures that your reforms have created in society and because reservists are now threatening not to show up. So is that not a failure of leadership by Prime Minister Netanyahu?
No, I don't think so. I think, unfortunately, some of these protesters have crossed lines that should never be crossed. We're a citizens' army in Israel. The Army should have never been brought into it. And
Wait a minute. Are you criticizing individual members for protesting at all? Is that what
No, of course not. The protest is a fundamental right in every democracy. Right. What I don't think you should do, military reservists should not come to an elected government and say, if you don't adopt this or that policy, we're not going to serve
democracy. You have Israeli military leaders warning the prime minister that this is a readiness issue. That's more than just the question of individual reservists.
Because the military reservists have decided that they're going to dictate the policy.
And the leader and the military leaders have said there's a significant
risk. But the people who make decisions in a democracy are not military reservists or military officials. It's the elected branch of government, and that's Israel's democratic leaders that have to make that decision.
And for the first time in its history, next month, the entire 15-judge Israeli Supreme Court will hear an appeal against the law that curbs its own powers. Will you respect their decision?
Israel's a country of the rule of law, so we'll always abide by law. But it's important to understand that the judges cannot be above the law. What's the authority? What's the authority that gives the power of the Supreme Court to decide to nullify a basic law? It's never happened in Israel's history.
That's correct. It's never happened. It's also never happened that the Supreme Court has to hear a case about curbing its own power. So again, will you abide by the court?
Will you abide by
the court ruling?
The Prime Minister put out two principles. He said the government should always respect decisions of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court should never be above the law.
Ambassador Ron Dermer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
After Georgia officials announced the fourth indictment of former President Donald Trump, threats of violence escalated. White House correspondent Laura Barrón López has more on the alarming trend and its impact on civil servants.
First, it was Ruby Freeman, a Fulton County election worker targeted and smeared by Trump and his allies in the aftermath of the 2020 election. The Georgia indictment details how members of the enterprise traveled from out of state to harass Freeman, intimidate her, and solicit her to falsely confess to election crimes that she did not commit. And last week, a racist death threat against the judge presiding over the federal January 6 case led to an arrest. It's a familiar pattern. Trump posts vitriolic attacks and conspiracies. Then, his most ardent followers stalk or threaten the targets of those attacks. Tammy Patrick knows the stakes well. She's a former election worker in Maricopa County and now the CEO of programs at the National Association for Election Officials. Tammy, thanks so much for joining NewsHour. Ruby Freeman and her daughter, who was also an election worker in 2020, have spoken about the impact of that intimidation on their lives.
There is nowhere I feel safe. Nowhere. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one.
This turned my life upside down. I no longer give out my business card. I don't transfer calls. I don't want anyone knowing my name.
Tammy, what did you think after you saw the Georgia indictment criminalize the harassment that Ruby and her daughter faced?
I think it's a much welcomed response to the situation that we're in, because unfortunately, for many election administrators, poll workers, and individuals in our community that step forward on election day to help their fellow citizens cast their ballot, they're faced with some of these same threats. And although it's extreme to have the president or the former president of the United States attacking you personally, there is still much of this going on to this day. And so we need to hold people accountable, because it's really creating a problem for the conduct of elections in this country.
Tammy, you work with election officials. What are they telling you about the steps they're taking to protect themselves?
Yeah, listening to those comments from the election workers in Georgia, I'm reminded of stories I'm hearing from election officials all across the country. Stories of individuals taking their names off the mailbox at the end of the driveway on the family farm where their family has farmed for generations because people are coming from out of state and attacking them. individuals who no longer go to the local grocery store. They have to pick up their groceries curbside because they used to tell me that they would walk down the streets of their hometowns and they felt like they were the pillars of the community. And now they feel like the pariahs because of the attacks, because of the assaults. But I want to be really clear here. It's not just the election workers. It's not just election officials. It's their friends, their families. Many of them get calls and they say things like, "We know your daughter's bedroom is the second one on the back of the house that is by the oak tree, or we know that your son walks to school in the morning and goes down Third Street and then turns on Elm." These are the sorts of tactics that people are using to intimidate our election officials and to try and scare them away from a job and a profession that they love.
Tammy, those are certainly terrifying stories. Do you see a through line between the experiences of Ruby Freeman and other election workers, as you just mentioned, and the treatment of the jurors and the judges this week?
We find ourselves in an environment where it has become acceptable for some to leverage what they believe are their First Amendment rights to attack others and to foment violence and to intimidate and to threaten others in their official capacity or in the capacity that they've been tasked with, whether they're a juror or stepping in to serve as a temporary poll worker. This is definitely something that is pervasive. We're seeing it at school board meetings. We're seeing it with poll workers. We're seeing it with jurors, with judges. And we have to understand that this is not the way that a free and fair society functions. And we need to hold people accountable when they step beyond that line of the First Amendment protections and step into the line where they're yelling fire in a crowded theater.
And Ruby Freeman and her daughter, Shea Moss, are both no longer election officials, election workers, due to their experience. How are those threats, the intimidations that you just laid out, impacting your ability to recruit future election workers?
In this moment, it is difficult finding individuals who will run for office that have the right motivations to serve in that office, who want to be appointed as a county registrar or as an auditor of elections or a supervisor of elections to serve as a county clerk. It's also just as critical that we have the hundreds of thousands of individuals that we need to serve at the polling places and to work in the warehouse, to work prior to election day preparing materials.
Are you losing institutional knowledge in the administration of elections because of threats like this?
We absolutely are in a situation where when individuals leave the profession, they take with them oftentimes a lifetime of institutional knowledge, which is hard to get back. One of the challenges in this moment is that with that loss of institutional knowledge, we could see the increase of errors. And with those errors occurring, unfortunately, I think it's going to be the case, because we saw this in the midterm elections, that any error can be turned and manipulated and leveraged and weaponized as though it is somehow demonstrating that our elections are illegitimate or that they lack integrity, when in fact, elections are conducted by people, for people, and errors can happen. And that's why it's important that we have infrastructures in place so when a mistake is done or happens or occurs, that we have a situation where we can step in with policies and protocols to remedy those errors.
Tammy Patrick of the National Association for Election Officials, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
For a breakdown of the week's political headlines, we turn now to the analysis of Brooks and Marcus. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Ruth Marcus, associate editor for The Washington Post. Jonathan Capehart is away tonight with a welcome to you both. And so looking at the week that was, Donald Trump and 18 of his associates were indicted in Georgia this week in a charging document that accused him of being the head of a criminal enterprise to overturn the 2020 election. And David, it strikes me that Donald Trump has legal problems in Georgia. He also has political problems in Georgia because As the Wall Street Journal pointed out this past week in a well-reported article, that really sort of captures the ways in which Trump fatigue is pervasive in Georgia, especially among some suburban independents and disenchanted Republicans. And then you've got the popular governor there, Brian Kemp, who has called out Donald Trump's election lies and has tried to push the party beyond obsessing over the last election. Does Georgia provide a roadmap for Republicans to move beyond Donald Trump? Of course, those Republicans who choose to do that, who want to do that.
Well, you know, the Georgia Republicans saw Trumpism face to face. It wasn't just a lies that happened to somebody else. It was lies directed directly at them. So they have seen the brute reality, and they are unable to escape the obligation to respond to that. I thought Brian Kemp would have been the strongest Republican to run against Donald Trump. He was a very successful governor. He's demonstrated his courage in standing up to Trump. And the fact that he's decided not to run for president, it was, in my mind, a tragedy to the party. So I think I'm glad the Republicans in Georgia are one of the few brave holdouts, but we need somebody to lead the charge, and Kemp was perfectly positioned.
Ruth, how do you view it?
Well, you asked if it's the road not taken, the roadmap, and I think it's kind of the road not taken. And we've seen this road being not taken by Republican candidates and Republican elected officials for years now. And that is because in their perception, which is probably correct, it is not in their political self-interest to do that. I do think one of the interesting political questions about Georgia involves Georgia itself. There are very few battleground states in the 2024 election. Georgia was close. As Donald Trump kept pointing out, he only needed 11,780 votes to get across the finish line there. I do wonder, since Governor Kemp won the state by a large margin, Donald Trump lost it to Joe Biden by a very small margin, if the impact of Georgia might be in Georgia rather than elsewhere.
Meantime, Donald Trump is also planning to skip the first presidential debate that's scheduled for Wednesday and is instead expected to sit for an online interview with Tucker Carlson, according to The New York Times and CNN. David, what do you make of that decision, and how might it affect the debate?
Well, he's saying I'm bigger than the Republican Party. The Republican Party wants its candidates to debate. It's the normal thing to do, but Donald Trump is no stranger to violating norms. I do think if I were just a Machiavellian advisor to Trump, I'd say he's doing the right thing. Why put himself out in Chris Christie's path if he doesn't need to? I do think it will transform the debate. Now it looks more like a debate of contenders vying with each other to see who gets to face off against the champ. And so I would imagine that this will be a bad and tough night for Ron DeSantis. The path to get to Trump leads through DeSantis. So it seems to me that every other candidate on that stage is going to try to take down DeSantis and tell the donor class, tell the disaffected Republicans, I'm the guy. I took down DeSantis. His day is over. It's up to me. And so I'm looking at it as sort of like the primaries to get to Trump. And there, hopefully, somebody will emerge.
In fact, Ron DeSantis said today, Ruth, without mentioning Donald Trump's name, he said all Republican contenders owe it to the people to show up on that stage. Donald Trump has made the point that Republicans know him, they know his record, and why should he share the stage with people who were polling in the single digits? What are your expectations for Wednesday's debate?
Well, my hopes for Wednesday's debate are that Trump's absence allows for two things. It allows for a little bit more talk about substance. I know this sounds incredibly naive, but a little more talk about substance than we would have if Trump were there. I also hope it allows one or two candidates to emerge from the pack and get their chance to shine. I do want to potentially take issue with Machiavelli Brooks over there and say, we've seen this stunt from Donald Trump before. He pulled it in January 2016 when there was a GOP debate in Iowa and he didn't turn up. And guess what happened in the Iowa caucuses a few weeks later? He lost to Ted Cruz, or at least the numbers said he lost to Ted Cruz. I think he thought it was rigged. And I wonder, and it is the smart thing to do when you're sitting on a lead, not to befoul yourself by being exposing yourself to your competitors. But it does make him look like a coward, as Chris Christie said. And it does create that space that wouldn't have been there if Donald Trump were in the room for others, Vivek Ramaswamy, Tim Scott, to potentially emerge and become some serious challengers to him.
Meantime, on the Democratic side, you've got Congressman Dean Phillips, who's on a media tour of late. He was on this program last night begging for a prominent fellow Democrat to mount a primary challenge to Joe Biden. He says that Democrats are saying they want not a coronation, but a competition. Is that a widely held view, Ruth, or is Phillips here on a solo mission?
I don't know if it's a solo mission, but I'm not going to say kamikaze mission, but it's not a mission that's going to end with what he wants. There are problems with Joe Biden's candidacy. There are many Democrats behind the scenes and a few publicly who talk about his age, who talk about other problems with his candidacy. But let's be serious. I'm old enough to remember 1980 and what happened in the Democratic Party when it was riven by division. And if somebody were to emerge and challenge Joe Biden at this stage in the campaign, him having decided to run, his vice president, who if he somehow chose not to run, if she were not the nominee, that would create some divisions within the demographics of the party. I think the Democrats are going to war with what they view as their strongest candidate, and with good reason. That's Joe Biden, and I think no matter what Dean Phillips says, that's the way it's going to be.
David, what's your view, and how might the Biden campaign turn his age into an asset?
Well, have him run a marathon. Have it do it. I agree with Ruth that the Phillips idea that there's some mystery moderate governor the Democrats can turn to. There's a lot of problems with Joe Biden running for re-election, his age primarily. His approval ratings are low. But anytime you look at some alternative, whether it's the mystery moderate from the Midwest or Gavin Newsom or anybody else, things start unraveling really fast. And so the Democrats are lucky, frankly, to have a candidate in Biden who has presided over an incredibly strong economic recovery, who has presided over pretty good international peacemaking efforts, both in Asia this week and also in Europe, and who I believe whose numbers will go up as inflation recedes, as it is, and the strong job numbers are there. And they're extremely lucky to have a candidate, frankly, who's not a member of what you'd call the coastal elite. And Joe Biden sends off all the right cultural messages for moderate independent voters who don't have college degrees. And Democrats are not grateful enough for what they have, in my view.
David Brooks and Ruth Marcus, big thanks to you both. Have a great weekend.
You too.
You.
Turning her interesting, sometimes tumultuous life story into comedy comes naturally for Atsuko Okatsuka. Amna sat down with her recently to see how that humor lands with an ever-growing audience and helps her sort out that life story. The conversation is part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Her comedy is physical.
Did you eat? No? Please, eat.
Her style, eccentric.
Wow, it's Atsuko, it's the weird one. Oh, shit's gonna get weird and crazy.
And she knows how to hook her audience. Atsuko Okatsuka is an internet sensation with followers who watch as she marries her husband for the second time.
The straights got married again.
Come on!
And dances with her grandmother, who now has a separate fan base of her own. Okatsuka rocketed to viral fame with the creation of her own drop challenge to a Beyoncé song. A million people watched her, creating their own videos, including tennis star Serena Williams and actor Mandy Moore.
My husband and I had an intruder come to our house.
And she shines in her first HBO comedy special, The Intruder.
The guy kind of watches this, freaks out, and starts to run away.
Her quirky observational humor has struck a chord.
Truly, there is a corner in my house that I sometimes take the time to stand at just because I pay rent. Yeah, I'm always like, this is like $30 right here. Why don't I ever stand here? You pay for it, at least feel it.
She sat down with me recently and talked about discovering comedy in an unlikely place.
What did you see or hear that said, this is something I want to do?
When I first watched stand-up comedy was through Margaret Cho.
So it was this DVD that was handed to me during a really, really boring sermon at church. You know, one of my friends was like passed it to me and was like, shh, hey, this is stand-up comedy. And it was someone who looked like me. And then it wouldn't be till years later that a boyfriend told me that I was funny and that I should try doing stand-up.
Yes, my fellow basic person.
It also took years to get her own special. Okatsuka is just the second Asian American woman ever to get her own HBO comedy special. The first was Margaret Cho over 2 decades ago.
I never saw Asian people on television or in movies, so my dreams were somewhat limited. I would dream, maybe someday I could be an extra on MASH.
You know, it's not about them going, oh, you can't say that out loud. You can't go, no, there's only enough slots for so many Asians at a time. It's just they show it to you. Yeah, so you have to push past a lot of barriers.
Why do you think it did take so long?
I think people are afraid of things not working, you know? People are afraid of things they're not used to seeing. But they have to trust the audience. The audience has been asking for it. And that's what I mean by like social media and like as stand-up comedians can post their own clips online and then they, you know, gain their own followers and go on tour and the audience is there and they prove like, look, people do want to see this, you know. Then the industry usually listens.
You have a story a lot of people can relate to, though, about coming here, learning how to fit in, making a new life in a new country. And your comedy special is called The Intruder. Is there another meaning behind that title, too?
Yeah. And I'm glad that, like, you saw it. Because it's not so over the head, right? But, yeah, the double entendre is that, you know, as a formerly undocumented immigrant, right, I oftentimes felt like I was intruding, you know, on everyone else.
What do you mean by that?
I'm coming to someone else's country. I'm coming to someone else's culture. And, you know, being without papers means like, you're not really supposed to be here. Anybody who's ever felt like an outsider, just because you talk differently or, you know, look differently or dress differently than other people, than the norm, you know, I think you might have felt like an intruder as well.
Her road to success was an unlikely one. Born in Taiwan, she spent her early childhood in Japan before moving to the United States at the age of 10 with her mother and grandmother. For years, she lived undocumented, hiding parts of her identity. Today, she owns it.
I am a product of divorced parents. Guilty, you know, was undocumented for 7 years. Due to a lie my grandma and my mom told me about how long we were going to be here.
Tell me about your family and how you came to live in the U.S.
My mom and grandma and I moved to the U.S. when I was 8. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I didn't know I was moving here. You know, my grandma, she's so sweet, unassuming looking, you know, this like old Asian woman, you know, but she was a liar, you know. She told me we were coming to the States for a 2-month vacation. And then she had us oversee our tourist visas. We became undocumented. We were living in my uncle's garage. And so that's how she at least got me to move to LA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The challenges, some very personal, feed her work today. And Okatsuka doesn't shy away from the tough stuff.
My dad's on his 3rd divorce. My mom's schizophrenic. At a certain point, you know, I want to look at my family and be like, guys, if you wanted me to do comedy, you could have just told me. You know what I mean? Truly.
You've talked about your mother's own mental illness. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important to weave those details into your work?
As a kid, I was always able to make sad things funny. Hmm. Not just for me, but for my family. It's just a part of how I communicate with people. You know, I go, okay, this very difficult to talk about subject, mental illness, no worries, let's talk about it. But I'm gonna make you laugh while I'm doing it, you know? And that way, like, we both feel better. Yeah.
Okatsuka continues to tour across the country, bringing her comedy and building connections wherever she goes.
What do you love about this work? What is it like when you're up on stage and you can make an entire room laugh?
Oh gosh, it's finding community, yeah. And my fans are fellow weirdos. You know, you're a fellow weirdo for even connecting with me.
Thank you for that.
Watching my comedy, even laughing at it. Sorry, you're not normal. And that's what I love, though, that we can all find each other and be like, yes, like, we're not alone. In all the times we might have felt that way. That's why I love it.
And we'll be back shortly with a look at what's coming up on Washington Week and PBS News Weekend. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps keep programs like this one on the air. For those of you staying with us, we take a second look now at a unique public art program. As with many cities in the Rust Belt, Fort Wayne, Indiana, went through tough times as manufacturing plants closed, jobs dried up, and people left. But recently, the city has seen a turnaround and made a big investment in public art. Special correspondent Kat Wise spent time with an artist who is a driving force behind that effort. It's part of our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
Above a busy street in downtown Fort Wayne, in a quiet studio apartment, artist Alexandra Hall brings colorful, playful creatures to life with paint and brush. Hall, who is 37, grew up in Fort Wayne and has been a full-time artist since 2015. Over the years, she's drawn and painted a variety of subjects, including portraits, still life, and delightful tipsy frogs. More recently, she's become known for her large-scale paintings of animals and bright, pattern-filled costumes.
I am inspired by a lot of different things. Travel, sometimes it's a person I see on the sidewalk. I have for a very long time recreated the things I see into whimsical animals that often have human traits or an anthropomorphized animal.
Tell me about the dripping of the paint. Why is that important?
I think that there's a little bit of chaos in every piece. There needs to be that release of control, that idea that nothing in our life is unchanging and nothing in our life is fully in our control. I tuck that into because that's been part of my life story and I think it's part of most people's life story.
Her life took an unexpected turn in high school when she was diagnosed with bone cancer.
Back when I was ill, I was spending a lot of time in bed. It was really up to me to create the world around me, make it interesting.
After recovering and going on to college, Hall began traveling and discovered a love of public art.
When I traveled, I noticed that there were communities that organically have a really strong public art presence, and I found myself more drawn to those places and those spaces because they have some sort of story to tell. At the time, I would say I thought, wow, I can't wait to live in a place like this. You know, this is, I want to leave Indiana.
Hall eventually decided not to leave. Instead, she's brought public art to her hometown.
So in the summer, this can be a really cool place to hang out, read a book, and it's a little quieter than the street side.
In 2016, Hall started a donation-funded organization called Art This Way. Now a nonprofit that's part of Fort Wayne's Downtown Improvement District, the organization facilitates public art projects on private property and the development of pedestrian-friendly spaces.
We work really hard to make spaces walkable in the sense that there's art every so often, and often enough that you are intrigued.
That art, she says, has helped breathe new life into the city, which during the downturn years had seen an increase in vacant parking lots and abandoned buildings. Today, once dark alleyways are now a destination.
Oh my goodness, tell me about this piece. So this is called 77 Steps. We've seen engagement photos. It can be programmed to do a lot of different things. We'll program it for special events and holidays, you name it.
The community loves it.
Yeah, the community loves it.
Art This Way's projects, including two of Hall's own works, are part of a growing collection of public art throughout the city. Nearly 150 pieces, including a new sculpture in honor of Ukraine.
You're supposed to engage with this, like a lot of the works that we install, you're supposed to be able to touch them. And here, you're supposed to stand and be pictured with your crown and your set of wings.
Events like the annual Art Crawl in September draw locals and visitors, and perhaps convince some of those visitors to stay.
There's more people moving in than are moving out. It's there, it's a big deal, and that's something to be proud of.
Bill Brown is a retired Fort Wayne business owner and former head of the Downtown Improvement District. He says public art has played a significant role in Fort Wayne's revitalization efforts, which have also included riverfront development and a baseball stadium. Nationally, a 2018 survey by the nonprofit Americans for the Arts found that 70% of Americans believe that the arts improve the image and identity of their community. In Indiana, arts and culture is a $7.6 billion industry, which supports more than 78,000 jobs. Brown says in Fort Wayne, nearly everyone is on board now with public art, but it took some time to get there.
I think the change was the realization that the arts can drive economic development.
Hall and other Fort Wayne artists have been building on that trust and expanding their impact, like Theopolis Smith, who goes by the artistic name Fresh Laundry. Smith, an internationally recognized artist whose work can be seen throughout Fort Wayne, including at the Bradley Hotel, has high hopes for his city.
I want this to be like a mecca in the North region to see the arts flourish. Being the second largest city in Indiana, the economy is growing. You have people in all walks of life coming into Fort Wayne to see what we have to offer. We want to make sure that we're screaming and echoing arts.
But as his city grows, he wants to make sure everyone is included and able to access the arts.
You have a fine line between gentrification versus revitalization and make sure that you have the right people at the table to make it cohesive. You want people to feel invited, feel welcome, feel I belong here.
Hall also wants to continue making public art more accessible.
What we've created is this huge melting pot of street art. We're seeing lots of diversity in the cultures and ethnicities and where someone's from, Brazil, Germany, you name it.
She's now consulting with communities outside of Fort Wayne. And over the past 3 years, she's led more than 36 projects in rural towns in Indiana, New York, and Pennsylvania. And while she still loves to travel, she has no plans to leave her hometown. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Later this evening on PBS, tune into Washington Week with The Atlantic. Jeffrey Goldberg is here with a preview.
Hey, Jeff. So it's a busy week, as you know, and we're going to be talking about indictments, all of the indictments, but with a special focus on the Georgia indictment. And we're going to be talking about Rudy Giuliani a bit, the seeming downfall of a person we once referred to as America's mayor. There's a lot to talk about, and we've got a great panel. So I hope everybody joins in.
All right, we will be sure to watch. And on PBS News Weekend, how families are preparing for a new Montana law banning certain medical treatments for minors with gender dysphoria.
At 14, Sid started taking puberty blockers, and at 17, began hormone therapy. The Beardsleys firmly feel that this was the right choice for Sid.
You know, it's basically just grown my confidence. It's made me a lot happier. And I actually feel like I have a future. I can grow up, be an adult. Like, I'm ready to exist on this planet.
Sid is among the last group of transgender youth in Montana who can legally receive gender-affirming care.
That's tomorrow on PBS News Weekend. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. Remember, there's much more online, including a look at an effort to address surprise billing for ambulance rides, which are not regulated under the so-called No Surprises Healthcare Act. I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.